Hello and welcome to this week's Stylect Radio. The show has come to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op studio in the centre of Bristol. Hello to everywhere in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world, including South America, we're told, accessing the show on the internet. Today in the studio we have Francesca Givens and Sophie Bennett. They're being interviewed by Katie Austin, and then we feature from Dialect's Katie Austin on the theme of feminism. We have a report from the Eco Village in Kew in London. Malcolm Greaves reads a poem by Thomas Chaston, and there's going to be from some Christmas carols. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show.
And I'm Katie Austin.
Well, our first carol is by Derek Bourgeois. What a name. And it's called Deck the Hall.
That was Deck the Hall, composed by Derek Bourgeois in inimitable style. Now, I've got two special guests with me today. I've got Sophie Bennett, who's just founded the Bristol Feminist Society, and I've got Francesca Gibbons, who's founding the Bristol Feminist Magazine, I believe. But first of all, let's hear a feature about an event that the Bristol Feminist Society has just run.
Feminism is a dirty word. To many people, it means suffragettes, it means extremists, it means radical women with hairy legs. It's also associated, perhaps, with student protesters. But funnily enough, Bristol University didn't yet have a feminist society until this year. Now it definitely has one. On the 4th of December, these girls and lads, funnily enough, held their first meeting at Bristol University's English department. In the lecture room were Olivia Bailey, the NUS Women's Officer, and two other speakers. She was particularly interesting. But more interesting were the feminists themselves. I spoke to a few of the students about why they'd founded the society and what on earth they were doing with it.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I just started going to the Bristol Uni Feminist Group, which was only formed in September, and I was quite surprised to find out that this was the first time that Bristol Uni had formed a feminist group, and also shocked to discover that there was actually Lads Mag that had been around for quite a long time.
So there is actually a feminist magazine coming out as well, isn't there, I've heard. Will you get that if it's about?
I've contributed towards Bristol City Group, which is different to the Uni Group, and that's representation of women in the media. And that was just out of curiosity's sake to find out how women are portrayed on radio, film, TV, newspapers. That's called the Bristol Feminist Network.
So do you think this will produce some similar results or opinions to that, or will it be much more radical being for students?
I don't know. I hope it's not more radical, because I think women could, or the people, the students here, could shoot themselves in the foot by being too radical, and it does end up pushing people away.
Hi, I'm Tessa Cole.
I'm Emily Miles. I'm Vice President, Tessa's
Publicity Officer.
We joined the Bristol Feminist Society when it was formed at the beginning of this year, and we've just held our first speaker event. We tried to make the first event very inclusive to all range of people that think they are or aren't a feminist. So the first speaker was Olivia Bailey, the NUS Women's Officer, focusing on why feminism affects students. Terrell Carver was focusing on whether men can be students. He's a gender lecturer at Politics Department of Bristol University.
So you chose two women and a man?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We didn't want men to be scared off from coming. We didn't want to give the impression that we weren't welcoming to men. We believe in gender equality, and therefore we have active male members, and we encourage men to come to our meetings.
So you're not scary feminists with hairy legs then, are you?
I have hairy legs tonight, but that's not fair.
What was the point of tonight?
Yeah, sorry, I forgot to introduce the third speaker, Judith Thor, who's very much focused about in today's society why it's relevant, because a lot of people, they get caught up in the girl power movement. They think that certain ways of thinking about body image or about feminine or masculine behaviour are natural or are somehow acceptable, and it gets very lost. A lot of people I speak to think that feminism is irrelevant and it's just angry, militant women who can't get a man.
Yeah.
And so the point of tonight was to show people that that's not the case.
So what is the feminist scene like at the moment at the Union in Bristol?
It's an uphill battle, I think.
Yeah. It's limited, but it's hopeful. Tonight we've exceeded our numbers completely.
There's... How many people came?
Well, the capacity in there is 120. Like, we had to bring in extra seats, so it's a really positive thing. And
wow. I mean,
yeah, so obviously there is a, you know, interest in it, and hopefully from now on our society, you know, will have...
It's
going to grow, yeah.
Yeah, and who founded your society?
Sophie Bennett.
Sophie Bennett?
Yeah, she's a second year. Most of the committee are second years, actually.
Yeah.
Most of us are people who were just shocked that there wasn't a society last year. Mm. That feminism in Bristol was that taboo, apparently, that, you know, there was felt that there wouldn't be a need for women's rights and women's equality. Mm. And men as well. And, you know, as we said earlier, there are men on our committee, there are many men who attended tonight. Mm. So it's a positive step forward.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, it seems like feminism is definitely alive, or it's being reborn at the university. What do you think the future is?
Just addressing the issues that have been covered up by the media, I think it is. As we heard with Judith Orr tonight, she explicitly outlined how women are still completely cut off from, you know, lots of major jobs, and being at Bristol University, obviously quite a good university, it's a relevant issue to us. You know, we're all quite high-flying and ambitious. Mm. And obviously to help women get the jobs they want to get, and just make it show the students of Bristol University that this is an issue and that it needs addressing.
Well, if you're not a student and you still want to get involved in feminism, you can. The Bristol Feminist Network meet at Cafe Kino on Nine Tree Hill, which is in Stokes Croft in Bristol. But for the students of this world, there is now both a magazine and a society. And I've got Sophie with me tonight, who founded the society. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, thank you.
Well, it's good to have you here. What is the point of having a society? Is it a taboo subject? Is feminism that taboo that you have to found a society to get your voice heard?
I think I was particularly disappointed when I came to Bristol University and there wasn't a feminist society. I think that often feminism has a negative stereotype, and what we as a society are trying to do is kind of reclaim feminism as something which is positive, and to tell students, male and female, that you can be involved in feminism, you can work towards gender equality. It's not a taboo subject. Get involved.
It's all very well saying get involved, though. I mean, people do a lot of talking. What kind of issues can people actually tackle through meetings and groups and articles?
The way that our society works, we have discussion meetings and then we have campaign meetings also. And those campaign meetings are looking at kind of widening student participation in wider events like Reclaim the Night and International Women's Day, and protests that go on in Bristol and in London. And then the discussion meetings are a way of kind of really helping students who aren't sure if they would class themselves as a feminist or not, finding out what they believe, what they think, their opinions on things.
So how do you define a feminist?
For me, feminism means equality, gender equality between men and women. There shouldn't be a 17% pay gap. These kind of issues, which affect all women and indeed men. But obviously feminism means different things to different people.
So it's not just kind of made up thing then? There are actually like stats that say that females are being repressed. Because a lot of people, perhaps the reason they react against feminism, they say, oh, but women already have such a... Yeah, women have the same place in society as men. Do you think that's the case? If you look around you now,
this is one of the kind of key issues why we held this event, looking at why feminism is still relevant today. Because so many people do think, oh, women have it all. But if you look at the statistics, I mean, one in four women suffer from domestic abuse. One in three students in a recent London survey said that if a woman is scantily dressed or is drunk, then she deserves to be raped, which I think is a shocking statistic and something that really needs to be addressed. Like I said, the 17% pay gap. That's something which affects all female students when they come out of university and they graduate.
Yeah, well, I sympathise with that one. Let's hope you're able to actually change something then. I mean, are you going to be out there at the harbour side with banners, you know, protesting for female rights?
Yeah, we have campaigns planned. We have kind of an active group now, which is really exciting for the new year. Obviously, we've only just started, so we haven't been able to campaign very much so far. But we're looking to do some active campaigning, get out there, talk to people, hold further events like the speaker event we've just held. Really, really excited.
So you're looking to get out there and active?
Definitely, out there and active.
Awesome, well, thank you. And obviously another way of getting active is in the print media. And Fran, you've tried to found a magazine, haven't you?
Yeah, hello.
Hello. What's your magazine called and what's the point?
The name is still a work in progress, but it will be decided before Christmas, definitely. So far it's just Women's Magazine, which is not very inventive. But the aim of it is to... Really, it's to be a forum for discussion so that people can talk about issues surrounding the women's movement and feminism, and not just express feminist views, but sort of to look at the critiques of feminism and maybe give people some answers to questions that they don't already have. Also, because there isn't, like, leaving the feminism aside for a second, there isn't a women's magazine in Bristol. Which is a shame because a lot of women enjoy reading magazines there.
Do you mean the whole of Bristol?
Bristol University, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
There isn't a women's magazine for Bristol students. And I think that's a massive gap in the market, needs filling.
Yeah, clearly. So, but what kind of issues are you actually trying to bring to people's attention? I mean, are you focusing on particular events? Have there been specific people locally that have, you know, been sacked for going on pregnancy leave or something like that? Is that the kind of thing you're looking to address?
I mean, the... events that we'll be mentioning will tie in very much with the Feminist Society. So we'll be writing about the campaigns that are going on within the Feminist Society. But also, I think students are interested in the wider picture as well. We hope to have a feature on Afghan women in the first issue, documenting the new laws that have been brought in, which have been reported in the media, but largely, I think, slipped under the radar. And I think students are interested in the local picture, but also how it relates to sort of the world at large. And so hopefully the magazine will have a bit of local stuff and community things, but also the larger picture.
Yeah, awesome. Well, that sounds a really good thing to be doing anyway. And is your hope to make that a professional venture?
I would very much like it to become a professional venture, but we'll have to see how it goes.
Yeah. So Fran, have you also started this to get across some personal views? Do you think there's a misrepresentation of women in the media, for instance? I mean, something like pole dancing, it's seen by some people as very liberating, and, you know, there are strip clubs in Bristol, there's pole dancing. Is this something women should be involved in your opinion? Are you trying to change opinions?
I think in Bristol there definitely has been a lot of controversy at the moment about strip clubs, pole dancing, all that stuff, because there's the pole dancing society is thriving within Bristol Uni, and Bosch, the Bristol University's Lads Mag, have got a Babe of the Month section, which is a female student who poses, not even that scantily clad, but reasonably scantily clad for, I presume, male enjoyment.
But, I mean, don't women look at lads in women's magazines?
Well, I think the problem is, it's not the actual... The Pole Dancing Society and Babe of the Month is not anything that I have a personal problem with. It's just the gradual erosion of the connection between pole dancing and stripping and stuff with the sex trade. It seems to have sort of been ignored, the fact that these people are imitating women who are paid... sexual services.
You're making quite a big leap there to the sex trade, just like that. I mean, is that something you really... Are you trying to say a woman, you're being exploited, you're being sold into sex, really, just by going to a strip club?
I think that going... Well, if you're working at a strip club, you're being paid for dancing in an obviously sexual and provocative manner. And I think it's the exchange of money for that kind of sex that is an issue. And obviously, the Pole Dancing Society, they're not being paid for it. But... it's people just stop thinking. It encourages stupidity in a way.
Well, that's a strong word, stupidity. I mean, you don't think that's... do you think women are stupid if they enjoy that? If they find some sense of, yeah, I feel sexy from this, is that a stupid thing? I mean, I've met a female author called Zoe Margolis, for instance, who celebrates female sexuality and believes that it's quite empowering and that the woman should be the dominant sexual presence. So is there no way that people are doing that, or are they kidding themselves?
I wouldn't deny that for some women it can be empowering. I just think it's a dangerous line to be treading when you're imitating things that are from the sex trade where money is exchanged for sexual services. And as long as you keep that line between doing it for enjoyment and for sexual empowerment and a clear line, then that's fine. But I just don't think that it's defined enough, as particularly as there are adverts in a lot of, in the university, for pole dancers, for students to go along and actually become pole dancers, paid for money.
I would just add that I think it's really important to make a distinction between criticising the women who are pole dancing or engaging in these activities and our society, which deems it acceptable for the objectification of women.
But what about the objectification of men then? Because there is, for instance, there's a bar on White Ladies, Sarsaparillas, and you can go along there, and I think on Thursday it's ladies' night. You can go and be served by guys, topless with bow ties, kind of Chippendale fashion. Isn't that just exploiting men's bodies as well?
Yes, that is also massively uncomfortable and I don't enjoy it.
So you don't enjoy that? Sophie, do you enjoy it?
I don't, but I think one thing that Judith Orr brought up in our recent speaker event was that the fact that women are exploited in so many other ways, and that women are... there is such a massive gap between a kind of gender inequality.
So that's the gap you are trying to close then?
Yes, something that we're working on.
Final thing, where can we find your magazine? Can anybody pick it up?
Hopefully, after Christmas, it will be handed out on campus, Wooden Road area, and it should be in the departments, the library, the union, all university buildings.
So if people went along to Wooden Road in Clifton at lunchtimes, eventually they'll be able to find it?
Yeah.
Cool. It's really good to talk to you. And if there's any final feminist message you want to send out, say it now.
Just get involved, that's what I would say.
Definitely.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you, Sophie, and thank you very much, Fran.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2 FM.
Our next feature is by Anthea Page.
Yes, it's an interview at the Kew Bridge Eco Community. Here, our reporter talks to Nick Ross.
Sitting in the middle of the eco village in the sunshine, and it's lovely here. There's all boxes of vegetables growing, the huts. Well, they're not huts, they're tents. They're sort of plastic yurts. And I'm about to go into the community tent where the kitchen is. I'm standing in a large tent, and it's made of hazel.
Yes.
I'm here with
Nick Ross.
And can you just talk us through this tent construction?
Yeah, tent. These are commonly known as benders. Hence, if you look up at the ceiling, you'll see all these hazel twigs bent over and tied together to form a lattice work. And then on top of that, you have your insulation or tarpaulins or anything that's waterproof to put over it. And that's basically it.
It's very warm in here. Now, you've got a wood-burning stove. Can you talk us through that? Because that is quite ingenious.
Yeah, I made this for one of the guys here, and it's made out of a Kayla gas cylinder with various, obviously, holes cut into it and doors put on, welded up. A hot plate welded on the top, made out of a car disc brake, and a chimney, and that's basically all it is.
And how efficient is it?
In what respect? In the amount of fuel? Oh, heat-wise, you'll probably be... when it's going full, you won't be able to get any nearer than about a metre to it because it radiates, because it's all solid steel construction, and that'll absorb 90% of the heat. So, I mean, it's very, very efficient as regards heat.
So are you planning to expand this, sell them?
No, I don't do it for money. I just do it helping people out.
It's a brilliant idea. And what else have we got? We've got a chandelier made out of...
Chandelier made out of plastic drinking glasses and just salvaged wire. And they've built themselves a generator out of a car alternator attached to the rear wheel of a bicycle. And then when you pedal that, it charges the battery and then the power then goes to these lights.
Fantastic. What else is ingenious in
this tent? Well, the next thing is wind generators that I'm working on. Rather than someone pedalling a bike to get power... using the car alternator again, I'm going to try and fix a propeller to it so they can hoist it up and, you know, have electricity on tap, so to speak.
So why aren't more people doing this?
There is, all over the country. You know,
this isn't unique then?
No, I don't think it's unique at all. You know, you talk to any of these guys here, you know, there's various places within a few miles of here. There's, you know, eco villages.
That was Anthea Page talking to Nick Ross, an eco-mechanical engineer in the community tent at Kew Eco Village.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next carol is a traditional song by John Gardiner, and it's called The Holly and the Ivy. You might recognise this.
In recent weeks, we've featured the Thomas Chaston Society and the works of the poet himself, and Michael Doble, the president of the Thomas Chaston Society, has come in for a chit-chat. Thomas Chaston was born opposite St. Mary Redcliffe Church in 1752, in a tiny cottage that still survives today amongst the hub of busy traffic and rising office blocks, one of which I work in, which is a huge office with lawyers and accountants in, and if you look out the window, there it is, this little tiny house. And our Malcolm Greaves, who usually reads our Book of the Week, is going to be reading some Thomas Chaston for us this week.
The Minstrel's Song for Maella by Thomas Chatterton. Oh, sing unto my roundelay, oh, drop the briny tear with me, dance nemo at halliday, like a raining river be. My love is dead, gone to his death bed, all under the willow tree. Black his crying as the winter night, white his road as the summer snow, rod his face as the morning light, kale he lies in the grave below. My love is dead, gone to his death bed, all under the willow tree. swole to his tongue as a throstle's note, quick and dance as thought can be, deft at his table, cudgel stout. Oh, he lies by the willow tree. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. Hark, the raven flappeth his wing in the briar dell below. Hark, the death owl loud doth sing to the nightmares as he go. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. See, the white moon sheens on he. Whiter is my true love's shroud, whiter yon the morning sky, whiter yon the evening cloud. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. Here upon my true love's grave shall the barren fleurs be laid, nee one holly sanct to save, all the kelness of a maid. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. With my hands I'll dent the briars round his holly course to grow. Oof and fairy, light to your fires, here my body still shall be. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. Come with acorn cup and thorn, drain my heart's blood away. Life and all its good I scorn, dance by night or feast by day. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. Water which is crowned with rates, bear me to your lethal tide. I die, I come, my true love waits. Thus the damsel spake and died.
That was Malcolm Greaves reading Mr. L's Song by Thomas Chaston. You can join the Chaston Society for just £5 a year, details of which can be found on their website. If you Google the Thomas Chaston Society, it will come up straight away. Our next feature is by Anthony Page again. It's some more interviews from the Eco Village at Kew in London.
Vendor tent now with Myrtle Merriweather and her dog, and you're going to tell us something about...
Well, it started off because you said you were from Bristol, and I haven't read this myself yet, but somebody who was interviewing me on Radio Verulam had discovered that Bristol Council have declared the council tax unlawful. Now, there are 500 people in St Albans challenging the council tax as being unlawful because a third of it goes to Europe, which represent treason and handing sovereignty to a foreign power, you see. That's what Europe is, ultimately. The reason that I've discovered this stuff about the council tax, etc., was because I started off as a peace campaigner, like outside Parliament initially, on the pavement there, and campaigning every day. And I wanted to discover certain things, like why the authorities could tell me that I couldn't speak freely in a public place and that kind of, you know, with the SOCPA laws and all this sort of stuff. So I started investigating the law, and I got deeper and deeper and deeper into this until, because I was getting arrested, you see, as well. So I couldn't understand why certain people had jurisdiction over the rest of us in all kinds of areas. I discovered that actually they don't, that we have to consent to all these things. So the Government Finance Act, all these different things we have to consent to. But what I'll do, because I've only got a moment to talk, you can hear my dog, he wants to go for a walk. I will explain simply to you the basis of the fraud that's been perpetrated against people of this country and around the world. On the earth, there's two things. There's two things on the earth that have law on them. That's land and water. And there's the law of the land, which is commit no harm, loss or injury. And there's the law of water, which is got different names like Admiralty Maritime Law, Fleet Law, Commercial Law, Shipping Law, or Law of the High Sea. Yeah? The way they've brought the law of the water onto the land, which is the fraud, the bottom of this fraud that they've done to us and turned us into slaves with these documents. A ship, when it comes into harbour, sits in its berth. Yeah? Birth is the operative word. It has to be given a certificate of manifest. And when you register anything, which is what this document is, you transfer, according to Blackstone's law and all the law dictionaries, register is transfer of title ownership to the registering body. So the harbour master takes ownership of the ship and all products on it, yeah? Now, when a baby is being carried by its mother, the baby is in water. So to bring us under the law of water, the woman is the merchant vessel, no longer a human being or a woman, the merchant vessel carrying the Admiralty Maritime product in water. This product is delivered, we have a delivery, yeah, through the birth canal, and as such must have a certificate of manifest or birth certificate within 6 weeks of being birthed, not born, and birth is for shipping. Yeah, so this birth certificate transfers title ownership to the registering body, the General Register Office, which is a government department. The government department takes that certificate and gives it to the bankers as collateral for loans, which is why people in war are called collateral damage, because we belong to them, right? So say that they said your life to the bankers is worth £1 million. They'd give the government £1 million and then they'd want that back with interest. So we've not only backed the currency, we are the only value, there's nothing else of substance behind the currency, we are also got to pay it back with interest. And it costs them literally, even if they print notes, 4 pence or something to print a £50, £20 note or £10 note, and yet they want that £50 back with interest. And another good thing for you to look at, if you want to know more about this, is that we've currently been operating in bankruptcy for 140 years, this country, since 1869. There's a really good article on a website called tpuc.org. It stands for the People's United Community. .org, and it's run by a friend of mine called John Harris. His talks are absolutely amazing. He comes to Bristol to talk and everything, yeah? He's living in Glastonbury. You can get hold of him and set up a meeting with him. He's got so much information historically as well as about the actual law of the land. And all these acts and statutes, Government Finance Act, all the acts and statutes, Breach of the Peace, Public Order Act, you know, all these different things, whatever the acts may be, according to Black's Law, on all the law dictionaries, acts and statutes are legislative rules of society given the force of law with consent of the governed, right? So we have to consent to every act and statute. Unless we've hurt somebody, committed harm, loss or injury under the law of the land, there is no crime. We have to enter a contract with them by consenting. The way we consent is to give our names with legal title, because that, with the birth certificate, they make up something called the person. Person, according to Blackstone's law, in Black's Law, Edition 3, they've changed it now, the meaning, is a corporate legal fiction, a piece of paper, the birth certificate. They can only act on the piece of paper. All the courts are pieces of paper. It's written down on a piece of paper. It's not real like you and me, flesh and blood, yeah? So in order for them to manage us, it has to all be turned into paper. The money is paper. I'm probably being a bit vague now because I'm thinking about my dog. Yeah, the place to look for all this stuff is TPUC. Look at the birth certificate bond and what it is and what it does. They float a bond on the stock market on the back of the birth certificate.
You're saying that the more people are born, the better it is for the government?
Yeah, and in fact, a very interesting little thing came out in the paper one day a few months ago. Australia had been paying benefits and pensions to dead people. And when confronted by it, the Minister of Finance, whatever, said that actually that was okay because it was also good for the economy. because it's generating more capital. Every time, mortgages, credit cards, loans, every time you sign your signature, it makes up the money. They don't give you anything, right? They don't give you hard cash. They don't give you anything. You sign your signature, and because you're the thing that is the value behind the currency, basically your signature is the thing that generates the cash. So for mortgages, credit cards, loans, you can challenge every bank and credit card company because you ask them for two things. Proof of consideration. That means they brought something to the table because it's a contract, yeah. Both parties have to have proof of consideration. You bring your hard-earned cash in the form of your labour. They bring absolutely nothing. So they've got nothing to lose. They have no proof of consideration. Second thing that they have to have is a two-party signed contract to make it a legal binding agreement or contract. They do not sign. The reason? It's fraud. Obviously, the bankers who are, you know, signing the agreements and everything, the people who are just doing the jobs, don't know this. It's just convention that they don't do it. They don't realise it's anything about the law, of course. Some of them do. I've questioned some of the bankers, but some of them basically know about this person thing and everything. But many of them know nothing at all. So it's
ignorance is bliss in this case.
I think ignorance is hell, because this is going to get a lot worse. They've basically, in 1844, we had the Bank Act. The Bank Act gave the Bank of England, because there was no IMF or World Bank then, Bank of England total control over loans at interest to the government. By 1869, we had the Bankruptcy Act. The Bankruptcy Act basically said this country's bankrupt, it's got nothing with which to pay. So then we have promissory notes. You can only bankrupt a country, though, for a finite period of time. You can't do it infinitely. Goes back to biblical law, apparently, 70 years. So the end of the bankruptcy was 1939. So what did we have? World War II, bankers funding everybody and getting away with it because they're the invisible ones. We've got the MPs dancing, the moving targets in front of us, who are just puppets. And then we've got the bankers, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, all these people behind, manipulating everything just for profit. It doesn't matter what laws are put against the people, they don't care, as long as they keep getting their interest base. Now, 1939 to 2009 is another 70 years. What have we just had? We're now in £800 billion of worth of debt, more debt than we've ever had ever in our history, and it's the first year of the debt. All debts previous to that were forgiven, so that means we would have had no interest to pay. We would have not been enslaved to the system anymore, but they want to keep it going. In America, exactly the same thing happened. 1913, they wanted to tax the American colonies. They wanted to fund a war and get a load of other people in debt. And so by 1933, that was the Federal Reserve Act, 1913. 1933, they were bankrupt. 1933 to 2003, bang, 70 years. Exactly the same thing. And this is what they're doing all the time. They're enslaving us with this fraudulent birth certificate. It's fraudulent because, you know, like in the commercial system, everything is contract, everything. So, and in according to the law, the legal system, you have as much right to not to contract as to contract. So you can say no to any contract. A baby can't say no to this contract. Needs two signatures. The baby can't sign. Needs a full disclosure. Nothing is disclosed. So therefore, it's a completely fraudulent contract to start with. And it turns you into this legal fiction called a person. Everyone goes on about...
What about the witnesses, though, on the birth certificate?
You can't sign anybody else into a contract. I couldn't go and get a loan agreement for you, sign for you to have a loan agreement, couldn't I? It's exactly the same. This is an enslavement document. It literally is enslavement because they own us. We have to use their money, even though it doesn't benefit us at all. Two presidents who tried to make the government issue money, JFK and Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, both assassinated, probably by bankers, because they wouldn't want them to take away their ability to issue deposits. Josiah Stamp, he was the governor of the Bank of England in the 20s, and he said that basically if people wanted to remain the slaves of the bankers and to continue to pay the cost of their own slavery, then they should allow the bankers to continue to issue deposits, which is what we've done. We don't know, of course, we're not educated into this. Now, you know,
of course, banks weren't always around, were they?
No, but they've gone back a long way. They had problem with money changers way back in Rome. Jesus Christ threw the moneylenders' tables over. That was because they were issuing half shekels, which was the only coin acceptable to God to pay temple taxes with. So all the Jews had to go to Jerusalem to pay temple taxes with half shekels, assured weight of gold with no pagan emperor. And they were able to set the exchange rate. That's why that happened. He was an activist, basically, I reckon. But yeah, there's so much things that you could say about it. You know, at the end of the day, once the people wake up, the other thing that, what I'm doing now is I realise that I don't want to see babies born with deformities from depleted uranium, Agent Orange or anything else, and they're going to be born for a long time in these countries that have been bombed by our supposed governments. And I realised that as I start to investigate things, that the bankers were behind everything and they always are the ones that get away with it. World War II, everything, you know, you got the soldiers, you got, you know, people who were heads of companies were up in the Nuremberg tribunals, but it doesn't change anything. We could arrest Tony Blair and, you know, put him to trial. We should arrest the whole government if we do that, and everyone that voted for it, and everyone who didn't, who knows the truth, because I've been educated, the MPs, and they know how to stop it. They know what they have to do, but they don't. So each and every one of them should be up for questioning, I think, not just Tony Blair, if they're going to go that way. But it doesn't work, because they are just the puppets. The bankers will always get away with it until we turn around and look at them and say, no, we're not using your money anymore. It's a joke. It's literally debt notes, a promise to pay in the future. There is nothing there. We start to break down how it all works, and you realise that it really is just a huge, big lie. They just, like, start speaking the truth. I've been taken off air last Wednesday for a live broadcast because I'd been interviewed by this radio station 2 weeks before. They wanted me back. The guy wanted me back to follow up and answer questions. The morning of the interview, basically, people had been phoning up from the authorities and stuff, and they didn't want me on because I was telling... Well, Warren, the interviewer, had just discovered that 500 people in St Albans aren't paying their council tax, and all quoting the same website, tpuc.org, which is the one I've been putting out in St Albans. 500 people. So they're scared. They're worried. I don't want them to be scared. I want us just to work together to make a new way. We need a new way of consciousness. We need to love each other and care for each other, not just exploit each other. You know, we need to take down the act of enclosure. We need to be able to go back on the land. We need to take down the Bank Act and stop them from issuing money. And if we want government, we need to direct them on how we want it done. You know, and we want, if we want money, then we should issue it ourselves. You know, it should, it's just for trade. If they can make it up out of thin air and want interest, we can make it up just for trade purposes, you know, which is how it used to be. That's what it was like in America before they did that. Yeah, yeah, Totnes. Brixton's got one. Forest Row are looking into getting own currency. Pence. Yeah, there's lots, there's quite Lewis. A few of them. Yeah, yeah, Lewis, yeah, the Lewis pound. There's quite a lot, yeah, going on. So if you want that, but I think ultimately it requires a huge shift, just a turning around of, right, we want to know the truth now, you know, rather than we just have to get on with our lives and try and keep going, because this is not, what we're doing is not sustainable. Just to tell you a couple of things, what I said before about statutes and acts being legislative rules, they're legislative rules of the Law Society. And what it actually says is, statutes and acts, legislative rules of society given the force of law with consent of the governed. So the last two times I got arrested for just speaking the truth, one at Downing Street and one time for just trying to, I was telling somebody their rights. Under stop and search, and I got arrested for obstruction. And the other one, I was on the Bank of England steps telling people about the birth certificate. I got arrested for that. I basically used that, statutes and acts are legislative rules of society given the force of law with consent of the governed, and I, as one of the governed, don't consent to the Public Order Act. I don't consent to obstruction of a police officer act. If I've committed harm, loss or injury, then show me the human being that's been caused harm, loss or injury. Otherwise, there is no crime under the law of the land. I don't abide by laws and statutes and acts because they can be made up and changed at any point. So I did all this at the police stations. Two occasions I didn't actually get charged. They could not charge me because I said, I wouldn't give them my name with legal title. I would give them my name but without legal title. So that identifies the human being rather than the person. Because it looks like you're nameless thing, but it's slightly different. It's just a little trick they do. So they'll ask you, are you Mr. Mrs., Miss, Mrs. or Ms.? And I said, no. So then they tried to put other. I said, no, I have no legal title. So all they had was my name, Myrtle Merriweather, my human name. Then they want Joinder, which it means they have to have two things to create Joinder, which is the contract. That is your consent completely. If you give them the postcode and your name with legal title, you've consented to the statute. Then they got you. So I didn't do that. Then they asked me for my date of birth, and I said that dates of birth were for ships. And I wasn't a ship. I was born, but I couldn't verify the date because I was too young to know, so therefore it would be hearsay evidence. And the first time, they tried all kinds of tricks, but I knew I was right. I knew that I didn't have to contract with them. They kept me for nearly 14 hours. Because they will try and push you on this if you're standing against, you know, they want you just to do it. Yeah. So they got a doctor in to see if I was fit for interview. I said, I don't need a doctor, I'm not contracting with the doctor. So then they said that I needed a mental health review, so they got a mental health team in. And I explained to them, and they shook my hand. I explained to them the law of the land. Offered me their phone, because I hadn't been allowed a phone call. And that's an interesting thing. You know, if you're mentally ill, you have to wait for your mental health review. And this was like 9 hours after my arrest that I finally had a review. They said I couldn't have a phone call until I'd had that. And I said to them, so if I was mentally ill, I wouldn't be entitled to speak to anyone. Don't you think that somebody who's mentally ill more needs to speak to somebody outside of the police station than any other group of people? You know, because that could be very scary and damaging if they've had a lot of encounters with the police under the Mental Health Act. And then they did an interview. And at the beginning of the interview, I said to them, just for and on the record, I didn't give my name or address again because they wanted that again. They keep asking. I said, for and on the record, after they read my name, because they got it off the computer from my previous arrest, put it on them, said it to themselves. I said, for and on the record, I have committed no harm, loss or injury. I'm not consenting to the statutes and acts. For your information, anything that I do answer is not contract. Anything that I do say is not contract. You are not going to be able to charge me. You will have to let me go. And 20 minutes after the interview, they had to let me go. And the next time, 2 hours, they knew I wasn't going to do it. They got my name, Myrtle Merriweather, end of. Kept me in a cell for 2 hours because they didn't want me to go back to the demo. And I could sue them enormously, but I use it for education with the police, because the police ultimately, Phil said to me, the arresting officer on that occasion, he said, but if statutes and acts need people to consent to them, then nobody would. And I said, exactly, Phil. Now you're getting the idea. I said, and you'd be left with the crimes of harm, loss and injury. You would be seen as a peacekeeper and everybody would love you. And with that, he was smiling. He looked very happy. And this is what people want. They just want to be happy. We don't want to be penalising each other. Statutes are just extracting funds from the poorest and most vulnerable people, usually, you know.
That was our very own Anthea Page reporting from Eco Village at Kew. More on that in the new year. We have an excerpt now from Hedge Trimmings, a whimsical tale of Wiltshire farming life, written by A.G. Street in 1941, read by Malcolm Greaves.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Too much noise. Noises at night that disturb one's rest are not, as a rule, loud ones. Those for which one can find no plausible explanation are the most disturbing. And of this type, those which recur again and again, just as one is dropping off to sleep, are the most terrifying. It may be a dripping tap in the bathroom on the other side of the bedroom wall. It may be. But is it? If one knew for certain, one could ignore it and go to sleep easily. But when one doesn't know for certain, imagination runs riot and sleep is impossible. The dark, allied with uncertainty, makes cowards of us all. Last June, a friend from London came to stay with us for a holiday. With true Wiltshire hospitality, we gave him the best bedroom, which happened to be the one overlooking the farm buildings. On the first evening of his visit, as we smoked a final pipe on the lawn, before turning in, he became almost lyrical in his appreciation of our rural peace. He expatiated on the scented tranquillity of the summer night and prophesied that he would sleep like the proverbial top. Next morning, he appeared at breakfast pale and wan, with a sort of hunted look in his eyes, and asked if the house was haunted. "Why?" I asked. "Haven't you slept well?" "Slept?" he retorted. "Not a wink. There's no such thing as sleep down here." "Cows coming in to be milked waked you up early, I suppose?" I queried. "No," he answered. "I reckoned on that, but I wasn't asleep when the performance started. I listened to it all. I know quite a lot about your cows now. According to your dairyman, Gypsy is a bitch, while Duchess is merely a swine, but he's going to warm Bluebell smartish if she doesn't behave." "But why," I chuckled, "were you awake so early?" "Because the place is haunted. Look here, which of your ancestors walks about the place all night long with chains clanking?" "Nobody, you chump. You've been dreaming. There's no noise about the buildings at all until milking time. The cows are all in the pastures." "Isn't there? I tell you that some poor fool in chains clanked them under my window every 2 minutes all night long. I looked out several times, but could see nothing." Then I remembered the bull, who is the only inhabitant of the buildings during the summer nights. "Oh, that must have been Billy the Bull," I said. "He's tied up in the buildings, and you've heard his chain clink when he moved his head." "Well, I don't care what his name is, and I don't want to know his pedigree. I composed a good one for him at great length last night, thinking that he was related to you, but I should prefer to sleep farther away from him." We shifted our guest to another room, and I think he spent a pleasant holiday. I've slept in that room ever since, and Billy never disturbs me. Familiarity is bred a fine contempt, which I express in magnificent snores, until my alarum wakes me to yet another day of farming problems. But I must own that even the countryside is becoming noisy. By this I do not mean that there are more moos to the acre, more bars to the rod, pole or perch, or that the number of the feathered choir has increased. These are sounds which blend with the rural landscape in perfect harmony. They should not be described as noises, but more fittingly as nature's pleasing accompaniment to rural existence. It is the recent imports of noise to which I refer, and to which many country dwellers object. Harsh, staccato, ugly town noises, which have invaded our rural peace of late in such volume that they interfere with the ordinary everyday things of our life, and in doing so earn our resentment. We were ferreting the other day, and after some good sport, we put a loose ferret into a burrow. And nothing happened. Just like that. Nothing. Any ferreter of experience will understand. The keeper then searched for the loose ferret with a line ferret. No result. "Dang 'em," he said. "Where be 'em got to?" He then lay down with his ear to the ground and listened carefully for a subterranean scuffling which would indicate their whereabouts. After a few moments he got up. "Drat it," he said, "'tis no use. There's too much noise about nowadays." He was quite right. It was a still February day, and the noises of the surrounding countryside were very insistent. And there were many. Tractors working noisily on either side of us. A milking machine engine was going putt-putt merrily in the field below. A goods train whistled raucously at a level crossing, then went chang, chang, chang down the valley. An aeroplane flew low over our heads, spluttering like a machine gun. Above us, on the downs, some men were laying a water main, and below another gang were erecting a hideous electric cable line, both outfits making the maximum amount of noise for the minimum amount of progress. Add to this the almost ceaseless roar and grind of that indefatigable giant roller skater mechanical road transport, and you must agree that the day when you could hear a rabbit and a ferret underground is gone forever. Fortunately, in this case, the loose ferret soon crept out of a hole and stood there at the entrance, blinking his pink eyes in the watery sunlight, until the keeper's large hand dexterously picked her up, and we were able to proceed. I must admit that in spite of the comforts and refinements which many of these noisy innovations are bringing to the countryside, I, for one, have a sneaking regard for the peace of days gone by. Electricity, for instance, will be a great boon to rural communities, but as I look down on the electricians swarming up the poles like greenfly on rose trees, I almost wished that I were a giant Gulliver and possessed a gargantuan syringe filled with the requisite insecticide.
That was taken from Hedge Trimmings, which was a whimsical tale of Wiltshire farming life, written by A.G. Street in 1941, read by Malcolm Greaves. To round up the show, we have a carol by Gustav Holst, composer of Mars, etc. and the Planets, a composer from the West Country. He grew up in Cheltenham, and his home is now a museum, showing a collection of family memorabilia. And this carol is called Christmas Song. That's all from Dalek Radio this week. We wish all our listeners a very happy Christmas, stuffing themselves full of turkey and snoring away while the Queen does her Queen speech and nobody listens, and a Happy New Year where you all get drunk and then regret it the next day. Our studio guests this week were Francesca Gibbons, who is launching a feminist women's magazine for Bristol students, and Sophie Bennett, who is a founder of the Bristol Feminist Society. Features were by Katie Austin and Anthea Page. Malcolm Greaves read the Mistral song by Thomas Chaston, and hopefully we'll get Malcolm reading some more stuff by Thomas Chaston, because he reads it so well. The studio engineer was Johnny Royden, and I'm John Peters Coleman, and the producer was Anthea Page.
Yo ho ho!